It's your girl, Shuli, and I am back with another conversation. We are here to speak it tonight with Dr. Kedra Spencer. She is from Louisiana, a hometown girl. She is a family medicine specialist, and she has been working. She is essential. She's on the front line. She's been helping people overcome their health challenges, but I'm going to let her tell her story. Dr. Kedra Spencer, tell us about yourself.
Yes, thank you for having me tonight, Shuli. I am Dr. Kedra Spencer, born and raised in a small town of Franklin, Louisiana. Did my undergraduate pre-med education at the Xavier University of Louisiana, the best in the land in pre-medical education. After undergrad, I did my med school at LSU School of Medicine in New Orleans, Louisiana. And thereafter, I love New Orleans. It is a part of me. So also I did my residency at East Jefferson Medical Center in Metairie, Louisiana, which is a suburb of New Orleans. Thereafter, the love of hometown kept biting at me. So I went back home and took on the arduous task of starting a private practice immediately out of residency. And it has been a wonderful experience. My patients are family, my family are my patients, and vice versa. So we all come together in a loving way, in a very nurturing environment, to make sure that the health of our community is at the forefront. So hence here I am tonight, wanting to step outside of the 8x10 of the exam room and offer and share information with the rest of my family to stay well during this COVID-19 pandemic.
Thank you so much. And again, we're glad that you're here. And we have people Baldwin, Louisiana. We have Miss Lancelin. And we have, well, First Lady Donna Lancelin, Yes. And then Tammy Son from Lafayette, Louisiana. We have Houston in the house. And people are coming in and getting seated. We have Franklin, Louisiana. It looks like you have your people in the house. Okay. And like you said, family. Tell me about family medicine. Of all the types of medicine that you could choose, why family medicine?
So I chose family medicine because family medicine gives me the chance to take care of a person pretty much from childhood on through adulthood and towards the end of life. So I get the opportunity to take care of every aspect of a person, their whole being, and not just bits and parts like sometimes you can find in subspecialty care. So I get a chance to form bonds and relationships with not only my patients, but their family members, their friends, so we can work together as a community to strengthen and improve the health of our community. So I chose family medicine simply because I love people. Okay. And when you love people, I want to be able to help and treat the whole person.
Family medicine
is an image for me.
Okay. Love it, love it, love it. And then typically, let's talk about the type of clients you see in your practice. Well, I'm saying clients, switch over. I'm get out of my work mode here. What type of patients you see in your practice? Like you said, you choose family medicine, but because I want to do a comparison, what type of problems were you seeing before versus what you're seeing now?
Mm-hmm. So in family medicine, we treat both acute and chronic conditions. Acute conditions can range from upper respiratory infections, lower back pain, skin infections, skin rashes, dermatitis, viruses, you name it, anything that happens acutely in a setting of a few days to a few weeks is considered acute care. So we do the bread and butter of acute care, but we also specialize in chronic care, conditions that are hypertension, diabetes, kidney disease, heart disease, high cholesterol, hypo and hyperthyroidism. Mm. Any aspect of a patient's organ system, your primary care physician, i.e. your family physician, is well-versed and adept to help take care of those conditions and refer you to subspecialists when the opportunity and the need arises for further care.
Yes.
So that's what we did pre COVID pandemic. And we still do all those same things now, but now we have to add into the mix and keep at the forefront, not only chronic conditions and acute conditions that generally occur, but now we have to also consider COVID-19 and how it affects not only the acute situation of the symptoms of COVID-19, how it interplays with your other chronic medical conditions, how it interplays with your genetic predispositions for other disease states. So now COVID-19 kind of adds into the mix, that adds that extra layer that we have to be very vigilant and very mindful in how we approach healthcare in this time.
Yes. And you're talking about those pre-existing conditions and things like that. Tell us how that plays into or factors into the risk for COVID. We've heard so much information, but we want to talk about things specifically that impacts people of color, specifically African-Americans. So we've heard that about diabetes. We've heard about high blood pressure and things like that. Is that it, or is there more to it than that?
Well, that's not it. There is more to it. We've all heard, according to the CDC recommendations and other governing bodies, that people who are vulnerable in terms of COVID-19 are hypertension. You know, that's a part of our predisposition in the African-American community and population. Diabetes, chronic kidney disease. Also, chronic respiratory illnesses such as asthma, such as COPD, play a part in factor. There's also now, and I want to make sure that we understand that COVID-19, coronavirus, is actually so new to us, where we are all, including healthcare professionals, in a state of hypothesis, where we're right now making educated guesses on what the outcomes and aspects and what truly the ins and outs of COVID-19 is. So as I speak right now, I want to caution you that we are all right now, day by day, we all notice and recognize that day by day, recommendations change. Day by day, as we get and gather more information and share information among colleagues and among scientists, we're learning more. So our recommendations change. And I'm saying all that to say this. Yes, predisposing conditions play a major factor in how well a person who would be susceptible to a poor outcome once coronavirus is contracted. Another thing that we found in medicine, that it looks as if the verdict is still completely out, because we're going to need to do retrospective studying after the fact to really get the ins and outs of what the true science is, number wise, statistic wise, behind everything. But vitamin D, I want to mention that at the forefront while I'm here with you guys today, because studies are out there and it's strongly right now being looked at, that vitamin D may play a part in helping the immune system when coronavirus is contracted, at being able to respond to helping beef up the immune system, those cells that are responsible for attacking the virus and ridding and clearing the system of it. So vitamin D, we've always known that vitamin D has a few important roles, right? The important roles of vitamin D, first, we know bone health. Metabolism, it plays a part in. It plays a part in cardiovascular health, metabolism. But we also know that vitamin D has a role in immune health. And so here we are right now in the setting of COVID-19. Vitamin D, we get it in two major ways. First is through natural sunlight absorption. Our bodies synthesize vitamin D in that way. So because we are African-American, that beautiful melanin that we are all composed of, some of us more than others, but all of us have some of it. Yes. As it is protecting us from sun exposure and other conditions that can be detrimental, it also plays a part in not fully allowing us to synthesize vitamin D as well as our counterparts. So we're more prone to be vitamin D deficient. And vitamin D deficiency, in retrospective studies, the few that we have right now, we're seeing that people who have been or are vitamin D deficient at the time of contracting COVID-19 actually fare a little bit worse than others in terms of morbidity and mortality when they are documented vitamin D deficient. So what does that mean?
Yes.
Here's the basic spiel. All of us, I said, we don't absorb vitamin D as much as our counterparts. So a great deal of us as African-Americans and people of color, not just African-Americans, but other brown people as well,
okay,
are more than likely deficient in vitamin D. Even without your doctor running a vitamin D test, we great deal can say that vitamin D, we can have it supplemented. How do we supplement vitamin D? Mm-hmm. We get it in our natural American diet, but the most important thing is outside of sunlight supplementation, over-the-counter vitamin D supplements. They range anywhere from 1,000 units a day to about 4,000 units a day. It's a capsule you can buy over the counter for a few dollars. Vitamin D supplementation right now would be a good thing. People ask my patients, well, Dr. Spencer, what can I do for my health? I am social distancing. I am making sure I'm washing my hands thoroughly. I'm wearing my mask. What else can I do to help me stay well, to help my loved ones stay well? Vitamin D supplementation would be a good recommendation. Now, vitamin D, like any vitamin, there is such a thing as too much. So you don't want to overdo it, because vitamin D elevations can have untoward effects in a person's system too. It can cause kidney dysfunction, kidney stones. There can be other issues. So you want to make sure you're not overdoing it, but I would definitely recommend a vitamin D supplementation along with a regular multivitamin. If you're already on a multivitamin, adding that additional vitamin D supplement should not cause you harm, because it would not go above the daily recommended dose of your vitamin D that's contained in your multivitamin plus that supplementation.
Good. Okay. First of all, thank you for the people that are tuning in from Denton, Texas, Baton Rouge. We have people that are chiming in, coming on. Dr. Kedra Spencer did not come to play. She's already given us information, talking so much about the vitamin D. Okay. Vitamin D. My follow-up question about that is, should you go get your numbers checked? Right now we know maybe is not the best time, but is it something that we should do? So it's a two-part. Should we go get our numbers checked? And then also, what's the number? Like, what's the magic number for having the right amount of vitamin D?
Mm-hmm. Vitamin D, definitely during a standard wellness screen or checkup, that is, if you do not know your vitamin D levels, it is something that definitely I'd recommend you discussing with your physician. Should I be having my vitamin D levels drawn? And the recommended vitamin D level is anywhere from about 30 to about 50 is a good comfort zone for a good vitamin D level. Toxic range of vitamin D is beyond the 100 range. Oh, wow. So there's a wide window. We want to make sure we kind of get in the middle of that sweet spot. So anywhere from about 30 to 50 is what you look for in those vitamin D levels. Okay. Oftentimes insurance companies, from a billing standpoint, don't necessarily cover vitamin D as a screening diagnosis. However, when it comes to your health, it's worth, I would say, even when your insurance doesn't necessarily cover a certain lab, when it makes a difference in your overall health and outcome, that's something you want to look at screening for if the opportunity arises.
Okay. And then, okay, so we have Mr. Wayne Curvey. I was taking 2000 IUs of vitamin D. Today I started taking Prevagen and the same amount of the pure vitamin D. My primary said that it is an excellent replacement and the dosage is the same as the 2000 IU. So any recommendations for brand? Is that what he's talking about? More of a brand?
So with the Prevagen that he's talking about, it is a vitamin supplement, and Prevagen actually has higher doses of vitamin D than the standard multivitamin. A standard multivitamin has about 400 international units of vitamin D. Okay. So in combination, as long as you don't exceed the recommended, I would say make sure you're not taking anything more than 5,000 units of vitamin D a day, and you should be okay and not be in a range of any kind of toxicity at all. So that's perfect, your Prevagen, as long as you're getting that 2,000 units at least.
Okay. And then Karen Barnes said, I take 2000 IUs once a month along with 1,000 over the counter.
Yes. There is prescription form vitamin D. That's where you get into the 10,000 units and 50,000 units. That prescription level vitamin D is oftentimes prescribed when your healthcare provider measures your vitamin D level. And if you're found to be significantly low in vitamin D, sometimes we'll prescribe the prescription supplementation until your levels are in adequate range. And then sometimes you'll be switched over to the over-the-counter version.
Okay. Now, are there certain symptoms that one could consider before they have an opportunity to get a test? So say they come in and they say, oh, I'm so tired, or I'm so this. Are those things that you can kind of put together or piece together in a puzzle to say, oh, it seems like your vitamin D might be low? What does that look like for us, like day to day, if it's low?
So vitamin D, honestly, oftentimes does not have a specific symptom. Okay. However, there's a host of nuances that can be seen. Fatigue is one of them. Doc, I've been tired a lot. I exercise. I'm taking care of myself. I'm eating right, but I'm always tired. Sometimes vitamin D can be associated with musculoskeletal cramps and pains when a person is deficient. Vitamin D also plays a part in mood to a certain extent. So, vitamin D, you can't really look at it and say, oh, you have these symptoms, A, B, C, D, so you must be vitamin D deficient. Not necessarily. That it can present in a myriad of ways in deficiency and then sometimes offer not much or many symptoms at all. So it's really one that you would need to know by testing your levels if you really want to accurately know, am I vitamin D deficient or not?
Okay. And then when you're treating a patient who comes in and it's confirmed that they have COVID and a part of their regimen, can you talk about that, their treatment regimen? What are you prescribing or, like you said, recommending?
Yes. So coronavirus is a viral syndrome. So right now we don't have antivirals or treatment yet that is a certified FDA validated treatment. We're not there yet, but we do offer supportive or symptomatic treatment depending on what your presentation is when you present with coronavirus. Initially, when we started out the whole COVID pandemic, we were taught fever, cough, shortness of breath. If you don't have that, you don't get tested for COVID. You don't have COVID, you have a regular virus, a regular cold, go home, you're fine. Now we know it's not just fever, chills, shortness of breath. We have fever, chills, shortness of breath added into the mix. We have sore throat, we have severe cough. Initially, they said the cough is non-productive. It's a non-productive cough. Well, now we know that the cough can be productive. You can have symptoms as simple as I had a tickle in my throat. I thought it was my allergies. So I took allergy medicine and it didn't get better. And now I have sinus symptoms. All of these things can be a presentation of coronavirus. Some people have very, very minimal symptoms. And then others have full-blown symptoms where one can have respiratory distress, mental status changes, weakness, and the whole host of symptoms. You may have seen a few weeks ago, the CDC actually added loss of taste and loss of smell as one of the cardinal signs or symptoms of COVID-19. That has been kind of in the mix since probably the first several couple of weeks of presentation here on the U.S. shores. Okay. That has been one of the signs of when we say patients and people, there's a lot of asymptomatic cases. Absolutely, that is true. There is also very mild cases. And most of the people that present with very mild cases, some of the cardinal symptoms are my loss of taste and smell. Where I didn't really recognize, didn't really think much of it, but oh, now I look in hindsight and yeah, I did have that.
But you would know, like you said, that you would know it'd be something so different. It wouldn't be like, oh, I have this weird bump on my wrist. Like it wouldn't be something that's so nondescript, but it would be of those things on the list that you mentioned. Like now I've heard COVID toes. What is that about?
Well, COVID toes now, what the inflammatory process that happens in the circulatory system or in the body in general as a result of a coronavirus. If you think of it this way, coronavirus is a foreign object, a foreign being to the human body, right? So the way God made us, our immune system is supposed to recognize, fight, blockade, and get rid of anything that should not be in our body. So with coronavirus, that overdrive of an inflammatory reaction, an inflammatory process of the body trying to take care and heal itself, sometimes can go into overdrive. And that overdrive inflammatory reaction can be manifest in many of the organ systems. So COVID toes is in the circulatory system down below and the arteries down in the feet and ankles, that inflammatory response causes vasculitis or inflammation in the blood vessels that can, you know, lead to this symptom of COVID toes. Very similar reaction in other body parts. In children, right now we have the Kawasaki-like illness in children that have presented and have had COVID as a post-viral syndrome. A few weeks later, children are starting to get this Kawasaki-like multi-syndrome illness. And that's also an inflammatory reaction. Okay. So it's, like I said just a few minutes ago, it's one of those entities of the immune system having gone into that overdrive.
Okay.
The vasculitis, which is inflammation in the blood vessels, can, in the coronary arteries, in children's heart, you can get that inflammation in the coronary arteries, which can lead to aneurysms in the heart, heart dysfunction, and things like that. So that's how kids are presenting. Kids are presenting with those symptoms. One of the cardinal symptoms of the multi-syndrome that kids can present with is severe abdominal pain. Goes back to inflammation in those blood vessels that lead into the abdominal organs and content.
And does that evolve into something else, or is it just that's it? They get, you say, when you say cardinal, does that mean that's the main thing that they get? And they have a stomach ache and they say, oh, my stomach hurts. But then none of the loss of taste, none of the loss of anything. They just might complain of those things ongoing. Is that what that means?
Well, see, those things, this entity that we're talking about usually happens after a child has already been exposed and cleared of COVID-19 or even has been asymptomatic. So this is weeks later. We're talking weeks later after the initial presentation.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up, because I was like, whoa. Okay. Now, Donald Robertson Jr. says, suffer from sinus issues a lot. A lot of the symptoms are the same. How can I tell the difference? That's a great question, Donald. Mm-hmm. You already have sinus and allergy stuff going on. How do I know?
So you would know the difference. In a severe case of coronavirus, you don't know the difference if you would start to develop any signs of fever along with your sinus symptoms, any shortness of breath, a respiratory difficulty, those types of things. Now, general sinus symptoms, guess what? Like I said a few minutes ago, in mild cases can present as, oh, you know what? I thought I had a sinus infection. So it would not be a bad thing right now in this environment to, if there's a question of, is this my sinus infection and my sinus allergies giving me these symptoms, or do I have something like COVID going on? The only way to really know is to get tested. That's where in the healthcare community, I think we lost some ground, lost some footing, because we were just looking for these few things and these few types of symptoms to say, oh, we should test you for coronavirus, when we missed a lot. And in missing a lot, those people who are walking around with mild symptoms, thinking it's my sinuses, it's my allergies, I have a cold, you name it, guess what? They're walking around shedding virus and passing it on to their loved ones. So if there's ever any question of, okay, what do I have going on? Get tested.
Testing is key. Mm-hmm. Testing is key. Another question, Jamal Johnson, what happened to the H1N1 cases and why is everything being accredited to the COVID-19?
So H1N1 is a type of influenza. When you say what happened to the H1N1 cases, you may be referring to a few years back when that new strain of influenza H1N1 came into the scene. It was at the forefront. Now, when you say what happened to it, we immunize against influenza type A's and type B's, all the more common strains of influenza from year to year. So that H1N1 that you're referencing is actually rolled in a standard part of your yearly immunization since 2009, that time frame when that new strain was found.
Okay, and then the second part is, yeah, why is everything being accredited to COVID-19? And is that even true? Because I've heard people say, well, I don't even think it's as bad as we think or as bad as they say. I just think if something happens, they're trying to scare us and they're calling it COVID-19. So this is a good question. Mm-hmm. What would you say to that?
And in my experience as a healthcare professional, now I can only speak for the experiences and the population of patients that I know the hard and true facts on in the area. So I can speak to COVID-19 when you say everything is being accredited to COVID-19. COVID-19 is a serious condition because it can range from mild severity to severe. So in healthcare, we don't try to ascribe and accredit other conditions, other diseases to COVID-19, but definitely COVID-19 right now, because it's, like I said a few minutes ago, because it's fresh, new, we don't have immunity to it, the majority of us. We don't have a vaccine. We don't have a curative treatment. We're stressing COVID-19 and how to take precautions and how to keep yourself healthy and how you keep your family healthy. That's not to discount other conditions, because trust you me that we are doing America, the population, our community, a disservice if we only hone in and focus on COVID-19 and people are dying of heart disease and other types of pneumonia and diabetes and you name it. So to that question, I don't want to say that COVID-19 is being accounted for in everything, but it's been at the forefront simply because we don't have all the answers yet. We don't have all the treatments. By no stretch of the imagination, I think that our community in general, we need to be very vigilant, be very mindful, but also at the same time, pay attention to the whole aspect of your health. We don't want to miss out on taking care of our full whole health because COVID-19 is here in the mix and we lose focus altogether. So I hope I answered that question.
I think you answered it quite well. And I'm thinking also as it relates to COVID-19, we're going into the summer months, even though it seems like we can't tell right now because the weather is all over the place. And many people hope that it would go away. That's kind of what you kind of heard, that it gets warmer and thinking like the flu, it'll go away. And it seems like it's not quite going away, but people have decided socially that it seems like the pandemic is over. But medically, would you say the same thing? Why or why not?
Houston, we still have a problem. So medically, coronavirus has not been taken care of. Please, please, please know that. Know that COVID-19 is still present with us in our communities. It has not gone away. And in all honesty, we don't foresee it going away in the very immediate future. So with that being said, yes, any type of upper respiratory viral syndrome that occurs. We would hope that as the seasonality changes, we get lessening of the cases, but we have not seen that yet. And think of it this way. Coronavirus is a virus. And if any of you have ever had a summer cold, the summer upper respiratory infection, guess what? Upper respiratory infections are viral in nature, and we get them in the summertime. And, you know, the weather hopefully helps out, but please don't think that just because the season has changed or because it has been decided that it's time to go back out and open up the businesses and save our economy. We need to do all of that. But please be judicious and mindful in how you approach your day-to-day living. Don't live in fear, but please be vigilant.
Thank you for that. Because again, Memorial Day and everything that we saw, that was a lot to see people gathering. And my nerves were bad just watching the people gather and have a good time knowing that I didn't feel like we were clear. So thank you for clearing that up for us. All right. First Lady Donna Lancelin said, Dr. Spencer is the best doctor. She and the Lord heal my husband and myself of COVID-19. She really loves her patients and took good care of her patients.
Thank you, Miss Donna.
Yes.
I love my patients and I have a passion for what I do. I want to make sure that as I treat my patients, that I'm not only taking care of them by the standard of care of medicine, because I do that, but I also like to make certain that I'm going to do for my patients what I would do for myself, for my family and my friends. So, Ms. Donna, I appreciate the fact that you recognize that.
Yes. We thank you for that. And with that said, thinking about you, what is your day like? What is the day in the life like in terms of patient load and people coming through? Like in terms of maybe you saw 40 people a day. How many are you seeing now? What are those numbers like for you?
Well, the volume of patients that I see per day has not necessarily changed over time, because as a prudent physician, I know that if I'm going to do it well and do it right, I can only see a certain amount of patients per day. Now, that may mean I'll see you tomorrow, but I want to make sure I'm taking the best care of you when I see you tomorrow. So the volume hasn't changed, but the amount of cases and COVID cases has definitely changed over time. Okay. Initially, when the pandemic started, I would say that in a day's time, I may have treated and seen about maybe 2 to 3 cases a day. And then those cases kind of ramped up to where, now I am in primary care. I don't work in the ER. I don't work in urgent care. So this is just primary care. Okay. The cases ramped up to where I could see anywhere from 8 to 10 cases a day, which that's a lot of cases when you're looking at 20 something people a day and you got 8 to 10 of them.
Yeah.
A COVID diagnosis. Now, while I'm talking about COVID diagnosis, I want to say this. There was a myth that we as Black folks can't catch coronavirus. I know y'all probably heard that myth, complete myth. So much so that we know, and you see it now, that we are more susceptible based upon our ethnicity, probably due to some of that melanin vitamin D deficiency and a few other factors. The few other factors are healthcare access, healthcare disparities once you reach the point of access. All of those things play a part in our predisposition where we're at a higher percentage of cases versus our counterparts. In my practice, I have a very, very diverse practice. I have many different races, many different ages, many different cultures. You name it, I have a patient that fits that whatever category you want to ascribe to. And guess what? Out of all of the COVID tests that I've ran on patients, 100%, not 80%, not 90%, not 85, 100% of my positive COVID cases have been people of color. So that means something, because the reason I say it means something is listen and pay attention to this. I'm a Black doctor. I understand and know the Black community. I don't discriminate against African-American patients. So when you take out all those factors where you say, where there's a potential for discrimination in point of access and care, I take care of private pay patients, Medicaid patients, high tier insurance, regular insurance. I'm across the board. Anybody that knows Dr. Spencer knows once you get into my door, I take care of you. I don't care what kind of insurance, what your pay level is. So when you take out all those factors of confounding issues, we still have this sitting here that 100% of my COVID cases are African-American. That means we are at a higher risk factor than our counterparts. And y'all, we have to do something with that. What do we have to do?
Yes, that's the question.
We have to make sure that we take care of ourselves and take care of others. We have to make certain. It's not a game, it's not a joke to wear your mask when you're out in public. Make sure to do that. You're doing that not only to protect you per se, because we found that it's not necessarily the case that it fully protects you by wearing that mask. Mm-hmm. But what it does is it protects your loved ones, the people in your community, your grandmother, your aunts, your uncles, the people that you care about. It protects those people, our loved ones. If we can't take care of ourselves, then who will? That's a part of taking care of us.
Okay.
Distance. When it's time for you, when it's time for us to go out and celebrate that the pandemic is over, I would be the first one with bells on. But for now, as for me and my house, we're staying home. And you know, I don't want to say that you shouldn't go to work. Some of us, we're frontline workers. And most frontline workers happen to be people of color, be it in the doctor's office, the hospital, the grocery store, the restaurants. We're frontline workers. We have to go to work. We have to do that. Do it mindfully. And when you get home from work, please pay attention to the aspect of handle your necessities. That outside partying and let's get together, that's going to be a time for that. And when it's time for that, do that. But now is not the time.
So much knowledge. Again, you came in ready. And I'm just like, gloves off, having a real conversation about this. And I appreciate it. And I've said this so many times, and I'm going to stop, but I mean it. We needed this. We really needed it. Going back to how to protect yourself with the mask. Perfect question, Melanie Renee. What's the correct information on wearing the mask as we're trying to protect ourselves? Some say it doesn't prevent you, but you already said that. But what's the correct way to wear it?
So when you wear your mask should fit snugly across the bridge of your nose. You want to make sure that your nostrils are fully covered. For some reasons, people you may see when you're out in the grocery store, they're wearing the mask to kind of cover the mouth, but the nose is out. Well, you can shed virus through your nasal passageway too. So you wanna make sure not only are you covering your mouth, but also the your nose too. So you wanna get full coverage from, trying to do it in the camera. Y'all, hope y'all see me. Nose, and my nose is kind of full. So y'all get the picture. Nose, mouth, you wanna make sure you're covering both areas. And part of that question was, do masks protect you? Not necessarily you, not with a general face covering or a surgical mask. It is to protect our community. Now, there are other masks like the N95 mask and other type of respirator masks that has some protection per se for you, the wearer. However, those should be reserved for essential workers, people that are exposed directly to respiratory droplets from people who have coronavirus. So doctors, nurses, if you're a barber and you're barber, I would say if you can get a hold of an N95 mask and you got to go to work, that would be protective for you. If you work out in close contact situations, nail technicians, anywhere where you are constantly exposed, not just out grocery shopping and doing your normal routine, but when there's constant exposure, something like an N95 mask would offer some protection for you, the wearer, as well.
What about the gloves? What would you say about that? We've seen a
lot. Good question. So, gloves have a certain level of utility. The utility for gloves is majority in healthcare, where gloves are for a one-time use. You wear gloves to protect your patient, to protect from contamination, one-time use. So when I'm seeing a patient or a nurse is seeing a patient, we may put gloves on to look at a rash or touch a rash or to give an injection. But as soon as we're done with the task at hand, the gloves come off in a sterile manner. Hand hygiene, wash your hands. That's as far as the extent of glove wearing goes. Gloves in the grocery store, touching your cell phone, picking up objects, putting gas in the car, and then go back and touch your phone, touch your doorknob, go into your bag, your purse. No, actually, it gives a false sense of security to the wearer. And so you're more prone and at risk to cross-contaminate, more so than just making sure to thoroughly, frequently wash your hands, carry hand sanitizer. Hand sanitizer, I think, will do a better job on your waist or on your bag than gloves.
Okay. Thank you. I've seen a lot of violations with these gloves. I appreciate that. Okay. When you work in a retail store, or retail, grocery store, frontline workers, like you said, there are so many essential workers out there. As you said, we have to take care of ourselves. What can you say to a person that's out there? And I see now they have shields in the stores, seeing different things. What are some extra measures that they might take? And so should they get tested?
So first, to answer the question of should essential workers get tested, when and if at all possible, it's a good thing, because remember, asymptomatic carriers definitely is a part of the way that we transmit coronavirus. So when you work as an essential employee, yes, you should be getting tested. Now, let me say this caveat. We still are right now still in short supply of the test, the swab it takes to do the test. So as much as I sit here and say that people should be screened and tested more frequently, especially essential workers, oftentimes our hands are tied in how many people we can test and how often we can test people. So we're still, in some instances, having to reserve the tests for patients who are symptomatic, who are experiencing symptoms. But if we're going to do this and do this right eventually so that we can all get back to some semblance of normality, we need to be testing people and asymptomatic people. So to answer your question, Shauna, absolutely, being tested is a good thing, but the test is only good for that particular point in time. So if you were tested for, and I'm talking about the PCR test, the test that diagnoses, not the retrospective antibody test, but the PCR test, if you were to be tested today and you tested negative today and were somehow exposed a couple of days prior to being tested, a few days after, you can still, even though you test negative today, a few days later, test positive due to a recent exposure or otherwise. So in order to really get a handle of testing and transmissibility, we have to get to a point where we're able to test more and more volume and more of the population in general.
With that said, is there a better test? I've seen they have, what is it, the blood test? You mentioned the different types from the technical perspective. Is there one that's better than the other, or is any test a good test at this point?
Well, it's each type of test serves a different purpose. So the nasopharyngeal swab and the throat swabs, now you can even do the tip of the nose swabs. There's a few different modalities where we can do the PCR testing, which is the test that tests for the acute viral disease. Any and all tests do have false negative and false positive rates. So the fact that a person gets a COVID-19 test and your doctor or your healthcare provider says your test is negative, there is still a chance that, although your test is negative, that you could still have the virus and be shedding the virus and passing it on. So there's no 100% test out there. And there never will be. In medicine, I don't think we have any test that we can say with 100% assurity and accuracy that this is a true positive and this is not a false negative. So there's some discrepancy in false negatives and positives. Now that's the PCR test we talked about. That's to diagnose. Now we also have antibody testing. Antibody testing is kind of look back and see has a person been exposed to coronavirus, because when you are, our immune system responds to that exposure and starts to create antibodies and other cascade factors that are now evident in your body when we test through the blood. That kind of antibody testing, there's out there now many different tests, like antibody tests, tens and tens and tens of different companies that make these tests. Some of them have been vetted and validated by the FDA and CDC, and some of them have not. Even those that have been validated, we're seeing that the chance of an inaccurate result is very high right now. So we're looking at right now, sometimes up to about a 50% chance of an inaccurate test result. So we were hoping and we were looking forward to antibody testing being a part of the answer to us being able to start to live life again, go to work again, start to do our normal routines. We're not there yet. Even that kind of testing, we realized that, okay, we got to keep looking at this thing. We got to do better so that we can get more accurate results, so that we can, in confidence, be able to say, let's look at moving forward.
Yes. Question: how often should one get tested? This is by Linda Vappy Miller.
That is a good question. I would answer that question in this way. How often one should get tested depends on the community in which you live. Meaning this, how rapid is COVID-19 in your community is going to play a factor in how often you get tested. But the main thing, I'll be honest with you, I'll say it again, the main thing is testing supplies. Are there enough supplies to test? So the number could be one time if you're symptomatic, and if you're staying at home and practicing social distancing and doing a good job at that, you may not be one that needs to be tested often. Someone who works in as an essential employee probably would need to be tested when testing supplies are more available, anywhere from twice a week, two times, three times a week, in all honesty. We're not there yet in numbers though. But theoretically, the goal would be frequent testing, but we're not there yet, unfortunately.
Yeah. And if someone does get it, going back to that question earlier in terms of the clients that or your patients that come in to see you and you have the asymptomatic, when they have it, there's been so much, and I can't think of the name of the medication that was suggested, and you were saying definitely the vitamin D and that kind of thing. Are you prescribing something? Is there a Z-Pack? They've talked about that. You can take a Z-Pack. You can do this. You can take that. What is your COVID treatment regimen?
So the medicine you were referencing probably was the hydroxychloroquine, which we've now found and know that it does not have any utility in improving outcomes in COVID-19. Actually, there has been studies to show detriment from the standpoint of the cardiovascular system. You mentioned the Z-Pack. Azithromycin and hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin and a few other regimens early on were looked at as a part of the treatment for COVID-19. That hasn't panned out as a treatment per se, but I'll say this. coronavirus, when it causes a viral pneumonia, right now we don't have a true medicine to treat it. However, anytime a virus is in the lungs causing pneumonia, that whole inflammatory process that I talked about a few minutes ago, that kind of inflammatory process sets up a nice environment for true bacteria to come behind and set up shop and now cause what we call a super infection. And super infection merely means an infection imposed on top of another infection. Those situations, antibiotics like azithromycin or a fluoroquinolone or other types of antibiotics would be appropriate. So oftentimes, when a person is diagnosed with coronavirus, if your doctor has taken that extra step past diagnosing, and I'm talking about on the outpatient basis, not necessarily inpatient admissions or through the ER, but from a pure outpatient basis, if your doctor has taken the extra step at past diagnosing you with coronavirus and gone on based upon your symptoms, because everyone doesn't need a chest x-ray and a full all out workup. If you have mild symptoms, you don't need that. But in people that have shortness of breath, respiratory symptoms that are significant enough, I would recommend it will behoove to also have a chest x-ray done. Why is that? Because a chest x-ray will let us know, has this coronavirus caused pneumonia? Because we can see pneumonia on an x-ray. Pneumonia looks like a certain thing on x-ray when we look at it. When we auscultate and listen at the lungs, you can often hear breath sounds that sound pneumonic in process. Those people, when you have an x-ray that looks like coronavirus type of pneumonia, I would say it would not be a bad thing to also in concert treat for potential super bacterial infections that can come behind in a post-viral state. I do institute that in my practice simply because not that coronavirus is any different in the terms of post-viral syndromes that can happen after you get any kind of infection. But if any of you have ever been to your doctor, and I'm talking 3-4 years ago before COVID-19 even came on the scene or anything like it, oftentimes we would tell patients this: I'm treating you for, you have an upper respiratory infection, which is a virus, but I'm not going to give you antibiotics because antibiotics don't work for viruses, right? And a good doctor will tell you that. But we also say within 7 to 10 days, if you're not better, give me a call because then I would prescribe antibiotics. And we're not saying that because in 7 to 10 days, your virus is worse, so now you need antibiotics. No, it's because we know that in that time frame, either you're going to get better, clear the virus completely, or that virus is going to hang around long enough to shut up a nice, cozy home for other bacteria to want to come on in. And that is the concept where I find that it benefits to also in COVID-19 pneumonia, also treat for potential bacterial super infections. And my patients that have been diagnosed with COVID pneumonia have done pretty well with that kind of concept into play. It's not new science, not new medicine. It's what we know in treating viral symptoms and viral syndromes.
And once they have it, are they immune? That's another thing that's going out there, a myth. Are you immune to it? I've had it. Are you immune once you have it? When they say, I've had it, I already had it already, so I'm okay. Are you immune to it once you've had it? And you,
we would hope so.
Okay.
We would hope so, but we don't know that. We don't know that yet, right? Because we're still just a few months in. So we don't have all those major retrospective studies to tell us that. If coronavirus follows the pattern of other viral infections and bacterial and parasitic, you name it, infections, there should be a certain level of immunity conferred upon us from prior exposure. How long is that immunity? We don't know. It could be a few weeks, a few months. It could be a few years. We don't know. It could be lifetime. We're not far enough into COVID-19 for us to really be able to say, give an answer like that with confidence. Perhaps we hope and we expect that it should offer some degree, but we're not certain. So in that case, even if you've had COVID-19, you still treat yourself as if you could potentially be reinfected, because the verdict is still out. We don't know that.
Be safe, wear our gloves. One time only, if we have to wear the gloves, like you said, use our hand sanitizer, wear the mask properly, treat it, take it seriously. We haven't been released. Is that pretty much it? That's
pretty much, that is the gist. You are not released. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. Not today. Not today, not tomorrow.
Okay. Talking about you and how you're doing, going back to that, because you have been an essential worker. You're essential anyway, but you've been here on the front lines helping people in coming through your practice. And we're hearing your people have been healed. You have witnessed a lot. You've seen a lot. Let's talk about how you're doing. How did you take care of yourself physically and mentally, spiritually, on all of those levels?
Well, I must say, I'm going to start off by saying I purely and wholly rely upon my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, to give me all the grace that I need to make it through each and every day and to be able to pass that same grace on to the people that I care for. In addition, I have a wonderful support system. My family, my husband is the best. Where I slack and can't get it together, he's right there to help pick up the pieces. I have an awesome staff. My mom pitches in, although we're social distancing and we haven't physically seen one another in a few months. My mom, any day of the week, I can open my front door and there's a three-course meal for seven different days on my front step. So those kinds of that kind of support is what keeps me going and frees me up to be able to continue to be on the front lines and offer up services to our community.
Okay. And then what about you and PPE and all of that? Were you, tell me about that process from the faith to the functional.
So PPE, in the beginning, it was a struggle for me. I'll be honest. The first several weeks, there were times where that N95 mask that I mentioned about maybe 10 minutes ago, I would have to use that thing probably for 10, 12, 15 days. I think the one time, the longest length of time I counted where I had to reuse the N95 mask, I think was like 16 days. Now that is to say, you don't wear it continuously when you needing to reuse and repurpose it. So it would be a take on, take off, wear it when you need it, wear it when you're in close contact with a suspected COVID case and so forth. But that's a pretty arduous thing to, in the back of your mind, know that these N95 masks in a traditional care, we use it one time. It's been studied for a one-time use. That's it. You put it in the trash, you move on, you go to the next patient, you get another one. So what is this N95 mask? How well is it protecting me and my family that I have to go home to when I've used it for 16 days? You know, so those types of PPE shortages were very, very mind-boggling. I recall a few weeks in, let my administration has been wonderful, by the way, of making sure, however, we got to find a way to get you another N95 mask. Dr. Spencer, we're working on it. We're going to get it to you. So they were good at when they could get it for us, but through no fault of their own and through no fault of anyone in our local system, just the supply and demand was off kilter. Now we're more able to freely take care of ourselves from a PPE standpoint. So now, honestly, I still handle my work life very cautiously. I take care of my patients with compassion. There were doctors who just closed down the shop and was like, nope, I'm not seeing patients. I don't want to see anybody. Close shop until this is over, until we hear better outcomes. I didn't take that approach. I stayed open and I stayed on the front lines and I was there for my patients, all the while doing that, definitely knowing that each and every day, I was putting myself on the front line and at risk in addition to my family. But right now, we're in a better place, a better space. It's not over, but I can take better care of you guys, and knowing that that when I enter the room to take care of you, that I am well protected, so that not only I can take care of my patient who I'm treating for COVID, but also the patient tomorrow and the next day and next week that's gonna need care too.
You are our Shiro. I look at the time and I think, wow, people still have questions, and we can kind of answer them on the back end when we close out. But I just want you to give us a warning and a message of hope as we go forward.
Let's do the message of hope first. My message of hope for everyone listening is that we have been here before, not necessarily in COVID-19 pandemic, but we are one of the most resilient and thoughtful and brilliant groups of people, to where even despite the shortcomings of the way that COVID-19 has been approached and handled, especially in our communities, even despite that, we're going to make it through, because we have to figure out ways, and we will figure out ways, how to support and care for one another. And in doing that, we will not only honor our past ancestors that have been there before, we know we'll make it through, we can honor and love and respect one another. So my offering of hope to you is to please, please, please know that we will get through this. And when we do get through this, it's going to be the result of not only our medical community, the different various governments pitching in and helping out, but for the majority, it's going to be us that makes a difference in our own community. So that's the hope I offer to each and every one of you here. We've been here before, not necessarily COVID, but we have climbed and surpassed mountains that seemed insurmountable. So we'll make it through this. And when we do, we'll be able to celebrate. Now, my caution and my advice is, please stay home as much as possible. The world is open, but don't open you and your home yet. When you have to go out, you have to go to the doctor, you have to go to work, that's one thing. But to just be out lollygagging and caution to the wind, please don't do that. Our loved ones are dependent on us. Make sure, and the next thing and the most important thing that I want to offer to you, now I'm stepping outside of Dr. Spencer right now. Now I am walking in the realm of Keidra Spencer, a young lady that loves the Lord and knows God is my source. I want to offer that to each and every one of you. That's also the extension of hope that I offer to you. The Bible teaches us that God didn't give us a spirit of fear, but he gave us one of love, power, and a sound mind. Now I want y'all to remember the love and power part. We got that. That sound mind part, pay attention to use that. Use the knowledge that's being shared with us. That's a part of that sound mind. Make good, wise decisions, godly counsel, educated medical counsel. That sound mind part is a big deal, just as much as the love and power. So that's my advice to you all.
And with that said, I will invite you to join the conversation in our Fear to Freedom group. That was perfectly said. We aspire to empower and embolden people with the Speak It podcast to exercise their power, to speak a thing into existence. Words matter. That's why we have conversations and we speak truth and we give people information so that they can live and walk in their purpose, and you have to be healthy to do that. Thank you for giving us the information and the hope and a way to continue to move forward in this. Thank you all for tuning in. Make sure you share this message. More people need to know this. This is great information. Share it on your social media. We're on YouTube. You can like it and share it, and just make sure that people know that they're informed on the things that they should be doing, things that they should be taking, how they need to take care of their bodies. And until next week, I encourage you to go out and speak it.